Ave listeners, a quick notice at the top of the tape. For those of you who are subscribed to the When in Rome podcast, I hope you have enjoyed slash are about to enjoy the first episode of our new series on Pompeii. For those of you who aren't subscribed, I hope I've just made your day. Speaking of, time for Emperors of Rome. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode XCI, The Roman Constitution. Today we begin a series on the fall of the Roman Republic, with a look at how it came to be and how it worked. The Roman Republic is often held up as a foundation model of Western democracy, and while it worked well for some of the Romans at the time, it did have its flaws. As the centuries passed, these problems became more pronounced. Here's Rhiannon Evans. Why are we now looking at the fall of the Roman Republic as a topic, and what are we trying to achieve with this?
Well, one reason is that we're going backwards from emperors of Rome. So we started with Julius Caesar, who wasn't an emperor, as we well remember, but then we did move on to the emperors. And while Colleen goes forward with the emperors, I'm stretching time backwards by looking at the Republican period, so before Augustus in the BC period. And I wanted to set the scene with a short series of podcasts that give the context for whoever or whatever event we might look at in the late Republic. And we're concentrating on the late Republic because we have more sources for it. And there were some really big events that happened during it. And of course, it led to the end of the Republic. We know that there is an end event here, that the Republic is going to finish and we'll start the imperial period. So as you might guess, it's quite a turbulent period. There's a lot of angst. There's civil war, several civil wars. And Roman society in some ways collapses to be gathered together again. This is why the emperors can exist, because somebody comes along who can pin it all together, and there are enough Romans prepared to put their trust in him. So we're sort of seeing the origins of the emperors in some ways, but we're going back a couple of centuries because Rome didn't fall apart in a day.
Yes. Okay. And what sources are we dealing with when we look at this period then?
We've always got Dio in some way, Dio Cassius's Roman history. We should remember that some of the time we have summaries of that. It's not always what Dio wrote, but he does cover this whole period. He covers the whole of Roman history up until his lifetime. We've also got, for certain episodes of conflict in particular, a historian called Appian, who wrote sort of a history of Rome's wars, both the civil wars and the foreign wars. Appian is a historian who's from the Roman East. He's actually a Greek citizen. He is writing in the 2nd century CE, born around 95. So like Dio, not quite as late as Dio, but like Dio, quite a lot later than the events that he depicts. We've also got a different kind of historical source in Plutarch, who I think we've mentioned before, I'm sure we have, in that he's writing biography. For us, very strange kind of biography. Most of his lives are what are called parallel lives. So he has a Roman life beside a Greek life and then a comparison of them. So he has this kind of theory that these two cultures are standing in parallel and you can take figures from each one. They're all men and say, you know, that Caesar put him beside Alexander because they're both great conquerors, that kind of comparison. So he writes the lives of several important Roman figures during the late Republican period. And indeed, Penguin has gathered a group of them together and called them, you know, the lives of the late Republic, I think they're called.
Yes, yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. What Penguin's doing there is gathering them kind of out of context. It's not the way that Plutarch wrote them because he had that parallel with the Greek life. But it sort of makes sense if you are studying the late Republic or the Republican period that you buy that book and read those lives.
But we do have a lot of contemporary sources, don't we? Or close to contemporary.
We do have some that are closer to the time. We have some people who were alive during the late Republic and the fall of the Republic. And a really important one for us, especially what we're talking about today, is Polybius, who's another Greek historian. He was actually captured. He was a prisoner of war and brought to Rome and then was there at the fall of Carthage. But he talks a lot about the Roman constitution. So he's a 2nd century writer, 2nd century BCE. But he was, you know, hanging around with people of power, with the Scipios. And then if we move into the first century, we have some names who are probably quite famous, people like Cicero, who doesn't write history as such, but writes speeches, you've got philosophical works and letters, and the letters in particular, and some of the forensic speeches, the law court speeches, refer to events that are happening at the time and certainly give us a good picture of late Republican culture from his often very biased view. And in terms of more straight history, we have two remaining works of Sallust, quite short works, so very specific events, the Jugurthine War from the late 2nd century BCE and the Catalinian Conspiracy of 63 BCE. He also wrote a history that covered a much wider period, but we only have fragments of that.
Okay, so there's a lot around by the sounds of it.
There are others too that we will take snippets from, but they're some of the major names, yes.
Okay, so we're going to start off in this episode by discussing the Roman constitution and I guess where the Republic came from and how such a system developed. So firstly, why did this come around in Rome? And did they have a template that they were working from at the time? So was there another culture that had already had a go at the Republic thing to this extent?
It's an interesting question, and in a way, it's unanswerable. But we can say what the Romans thought about it and what's likely to have happened. So the Roman Republic is thought to have started in 509 BCE. They had a very precise year for it happening, you know, and they, one of the ways they counted their years was by who was consul that year, so you can count back. The other way is from the foundation of the city, and they had a precise date for that too. So they thought the Republic started in 509, and that the previous year, 510, they had thrown the kings out of Rome. They had had seven kings, starting with Romulus. The last king in particular, who was Etruscan, Tarquin the Proud, was too proud. And his son had done something outrageous. He had raped an elite woman called Lucretia. And for that and other crimes, they had evicted the kings.
Okay, yeah.
So that's supposed to be the beginning of the Republic. It comes as a result of an ousting of monarchy, a getting rid of monarchy, which is a really important, not quite foundational myth. The foundation myth is Romulus, but the foundational myth for the Republic, which shows us that they had a real antipathy towards monarchy, to one-man rule. And this is in some ways why the US Constitution borrows so much from the Roman, because they have a similar kind of history of ejecting a king, rejecting a king, I guess, in the British monarchy. Yes.
So it was a conscious decision then to give rule to the people, initially, at least.
Well, according to Roman myth, you can call it, really,
because
we don't have concrete history about the 6th century BCE, but we do think that there was some kind of change of constitution, change of government around that time. The fallacy is what we're going to talk about today in terms of who was in charge in the Roman Republic, that was there at the beginning. That's almost certainly not the case. It developed over time. All right. So they didn't just formulate a constitution and then it was set in stone in the 6th century and it was always the same. But what they seem to have done is to have split up the rule from being just one person in charge to two people being in charge. So they have two consuls.
And even those are regularly replaced.
Yeah, there's also term limits.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that this is the rule of the people myself, and we can talk about why in a little while, but it's certainly a nod towards what we would call democracy as opposed to monarchy, where you have absolute rule by one person. And now in terms of parallels, there is quite an interesting parallel, and this is something that historians have kicked around a lot, in that Athens at around the same time is inventing its democracy.
So it's
kind of getting rid of the oligarchy, the rule of the few, and instituting democracy, which was actually a fraught process in that it was ousted itself and came back a short time later. But basically, the 5th century BCE was the period when Athens had democracy of a form that is much more radical than what we see at Rome or almost anywhere else in antiquity, because it's direct democracy quite often, so that they'll have everybody who is able to vote voting, which is men.
Tell me about the Roman constitution. They didn't have a formal constitution, a written down constitution with thought or planning put in beforehand, if I can be critical and call it that. But they did have a set of rules, mostly that they came to through precedents. Is that fair?
Yes. Yeah, the Romans are obsessed with precedent. That's a good word to use here. They have tradition. All right. So you don't have a constitution in the way that the US again has that, you know, written down paragraph by paragraph
yeah.
how this country will work. But if something has happened before, then it's likely it will happen again. What they do have is they have a strong legal system. And we know that as early as the 5th century in 450 BCE, they're writing down laws. And they have this combination of tradition and authority, which leads us to something interesting about their form of government. The Republican form of government has, as one of its most important bodies, the Senate. Now, the Senate has no formal power, not like the US or the Australian system in that way. They have a lot of authority, right? The people who get to be in the Senate, who get to be there because they have the right amount of property, they will debate laws, and what they decide is likely to be carried because they've got authority. So that's where we should bear in mind that it's not necessarily about a set of lawmakers who have legislative or executive power. It's about influence and authority.
So who were the magistrates then, and what were their powers?
The two most powerful magistrates are the consuls, who kind of replace the king in a way, but there are two of them. They have what is called imperium, supreme power. They have the power to do things like lead a Roman army into battle, and they can also veto each other. So the veto is a really important power. And it means that if the consuls disagree, then nothing gets changed.
Yeah, I've got the last say.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually the Latin word meaning I refuse.
Yeah.
No. It's the closest to no, or one of the words they have for no, because there's no word for no in Latin. However, their power, although it's almost absolute, is limited because of term limits. Their limit is a year. It's not a long time to get things done.
No, it's hardly any.
The term limits are an important part of the Roman constitution and something that is still kind of copied by our modern governments. We tend to think it's a bit strange if someone's in power for many, many years, don't we? We think they're moving towards dictatorship. Term limits mean that after their term in office, everyone has to answer for their actions during office. So while they're in office, they have immunity. They can't be prosecuted.
Right.
But after that, they can be prosecuted for anything that was illegal, for extortion.
Yeah.
That's a very frequent one. And they will be put on trial in the Senate.
All right. So a list is being kept. Is that just for consuls? That's not just for consuls, is it?
No, that's for all of the magistracies. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So who else were magistrates?
Okay. So you kind of have developing through the Republic a career path where you start as the lowest magistracy, which is called a quaestor. Then you move to a praetor, and then you might get to be consul.
And do they have different term limits?
They tend to be a year as well.
Okay.
Most magistracies are a year. There are some extraordinary ones that might last longer. Quaestors tend to be involved in financial matters, so treasury officials.
Yeah.
Praetors can vary a lot. One of the important roles they have is in the military, so they can lead an army. And if they're leading an army, they have imperium too.
Mm.
But they can also have other more domestic roles too. But there are fewer and fewer as you go through the ranks, and this changed over time. But there are periods where you have, say, 10 quaestors and 6 praetors and 2 consuls.
Yeah.
And everyone wants to be consul. Mm. So it's a very competitive process. The net result of this was that these officials tended to put on games or offer donations to the people to get their votes. These roles are voted for.
Yeah.
So there is that democratic element. Roman citizens, male Roman citizens, can vote for these officials. In theory, you were also restricted by age. Now, this changed. It's actually a law that came in 81 BCE by Sulla. And he made a law that you had to be 42 to be consul, 39 to be praetor, and 30 to be quaestor. So he put those minimum ages in. Previously, it had been based on how much military service you'd had and having particular gaps between the magistracies. But this was becoming too awkward to police, and maybe too many people were eligible. He was sort of in charge of a civil war at that point. So Sulla's policies seem generally to have tried to regulate this and to make sure that particular families continued to get these magistracies.
Yeah,
he almost certainly would have been doing this to favour certain elements of the oligarchy.
A little bit of age equals wisdom kind of thinking as well.
There is a bit of that, but that's kind of a Roman tradition anyway. So he's feeding into that tradition. I mean, 30 is pretty young for the Romans. The Romans do very much value the wisdom of ages. These laws have already been broken, though. This is one reason Sulla brings this in, because another important name at that time, Marius, they'd had to break these laws for him. So if it's already not working, then why not at least codify what's happening?
Yeah, they set some precedent there. Okay, can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. If you start out at Quaestor, work your way up to consul, you're consul then for a year, can you go back to another magistracy role?
Well, what happens after you're consul is that you are given a term of office as a proconsul.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, this happens once Rome has garnered an empire. It's not happening at the beginning of the Republic. You go out to one of the provinces. And you basically are the governor. It's usually translated of you're the proconsul or governor of that province. And that can be for a longer period of time. This was quite extraordinary, but Caesar was given 5 years in Gaul.
Yes.
And then it was extended. And when you're proconsul, again, you have immunity until the end of your term of office. And you can be consul again. Now, technically, there's meant to be a 10-year gap between consulships. This almost certainly varied during the Republic as well. So earlier on, there was meant to be a 2-year gap between being quaestor and then being praetor and consul.
Mm.
But the form that usually comes down to us is the minimum ages for each of those roles and then 10-year gaps between consulships.
Yeah.
In the period we're going to be looking at, and this is why it's important to have this background, we'll see that that starts to fall apart. That rule gets disobeyed all of the time.
Right, yeah, so it sounds like a lot of these rules are just going to be turfed if they're inconvenient.
Yes.
Or just slightly ignored. But it would make things really difficult to be done. If you're in a magistrate role for a year and then you hand it off to the next person, either things happen really quickly or they don't happen at all.
Well, it would be different at different periods during the Republic, because in the early Republic, you know, Rome doesn't have a lot of outside power.
Mm.
It's not that complicated. Throughout the 4th, 3rd century, it's conquering Italy, and then it starts to build provinces outside of Italy. We think of it as complicated because our governments are responsible for so much more than,
yes,
or they tend to be in liberal democracies, than the Roman government was. So, you know, the most the Roman government has in the early period in terms of social policy is the corn dole, which is something that makes sure that everyone's fed. They're not even that responsible for building the city itself. That tends to be private individuals who are often trying to build their own family's glory or to curry favor,
yeah,
with the populace. Mm. And they might have to get the approval of the Senate to do that building, but they're kind of doing it to bolster themselves.
Mm.
So there's a certain amount of city planning, but, you know, Rome is quite higgledy-piggledy, and there's a reason for that. There's not really a great master plan, at most stages during the Republic. So I don't think it is that difficult to make a mark within 1 year, because in a way, these people want to be consul partly for themselves and their own glory and the power, and then to go on and be proconsul in a province.
Okay, so things aren't so mired in bureaucracy.
There's not as much bureaucracy.
Okay.
Despite the Romans' love of legalism. And I should emphasize, by the way, that only elite men will ever get onto this career ladder, because in order to qualify to stand for election, you're going to have a lot of money to spend on the people. You're going to have come from a senatorial family, usually. And to be in the Senate, you need to have property of 1 million sesterces. The wealth gap in Roman antiquity was like nothing we can imagine in modernity. So you need to be extremely wealthy anyway. What this means is that only people from that top tier are ever going to be in these positions. So if you're going to say that this is anything in our terms, then it's probably an oligarchy. It's a rule of the few. It's not monarchy anymore. It's not really democracy, despite the fact that there is a voting system. Magistracies and laws get voted on by the assemblies of the people, as they're called.
Yeah.
So I would call this oligarchy, but Polybius would not agree with me exactly. He's that Greek historian from the 2nd century BCE, and he has one of the most famous summaries of the Roman Republican system, Book 6 of Polybius's History, 6:11. The three kinds of government that I spoke of above all shared in the control of the Roman state. And what he means by that is monarchy, oligarchy, and democracy. And he goes on to explain. And such fairness and propriety in all respects was shown in the use of these three elements for drawing up the constitution and in its subsequent administration that it was impossible even for a native to pronounce with certainty whether the whole system was aristocratic, democratic, or monarchical. He's sort of using the word aristocratic, or I would use oligarchical there. All mm-hmm. right. So the rule of the best people technically means, or the rule of the few. This was indeed only natural, for if one fixed one's eyes on the power of the consuls, the constitution seemed completely monarchical and royal. The consuls were like kings, in other words. If on that of the Senate, it seemed again to be aristocratic. And when one looked at the power of the masses, it seemed clearly to be a democracy. Now, he has a much longer exposition of that in that same part of Book 6,
yeah.
if anyone wants to read more on it. But that's the summary of it. He says basically the Roman model is a hybrid. It has elements of all three forms there, and he can't really put a name to it. I think he sees it means that you've got that balance. Everybody is kept happy to a certain extent.
Mm.
He was sort of won over by the Romans, whether he had to be because he was a prisoner of war, but he actually saw them as quite a successful society.
So what was this power? How did they decide who got it? And were there any rules in play there?
Well, the power of the masses, it sounds grander than it really is, because for the masses, although they could vote, their votes weren't worth an awful lot.
Mm.
So if you were an ordinary Roman citizen without much property, and property is all important to the Romans, you get to vote, but you get to vote in what is called a college. And your college is with other people who have a similar amount of property to you. But if you're, you know, someone with one small field that you have a subsistence existence on, then your college is huge. It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you vote together, whoever you vote for, then maybe your college gets 10 votes. That's 10 votes for that person.
All right. So it's districts of a sort.
Yes. But if you have an awful lot of property and you own vast estates,
yeah.
there aren't going to be as many of you. You vote together for a particular person, and whoever gets the most votes within your college, maybe that's worth 100 votes.
Okay.
So it's not a fair system at all, and it is very much skewed towards the power of the oligarchy. All right. So when you're going through the votes, it's probably already been decided by the time you get to the people of middling income and property. So the people at the bottom, their votes are irrelevant.
So it is a bit like districts, but drawn up by wealth almost,
yeah.
not by population living in an area. So you might have a very small district, which is essentially a city, but you know, you've got the same amount of a population living in a state. It's why the districts tend to be larger the further you get out from cities.
Yeah, we tried to make that system fair by, you know, the size of a district according to population.
Yeah.
The Romans actually deliberately skewed it by giving more power to those with more property.
Yes. Well, and there's ways around every system by the sounds of it.
There are, but then the people who benefited from the Roman system, it was to their advantage not to change that system.
Yeah.
Until there is so much competition for the top role that it's not actually useful to continue with that system anymore. And it also gradually becomes clear that there are problems with the Roman Republic because land is being bought up and gathered in the hands of the few, and those few are actually the people in the Senate. So you start to have more divisions within Roman society. This happens over, you know, decades and centuries. But this is one of the reasons the Roman Republic begins to fall apart. It's not so much that people are clamoring for democracy. It's not that idealism as such. It's that other elements begin to fall apart.
How did the Republic change over time then?
Well, it's important to notice that what I've been talking about really describes what we know of as the system in the late Republic, largely. The Republic almost certainly changed vastly over time. One example is that we know that in the 5th and 4th centuries, there was a lot of conflict between the orders, as we call them. So Roman society traditionally had been based on Roman citizens fitting into two categories. They were either plebs or patricians. All right, and most people were plebs.
Mm.
They were from plebeian families. The patricians, their name is based on the Latin word for father. They are sort of aligned with the Senate. The word Senate itself means old people, the older place.
Yeah.
They're the elite. If you're born into a patrician family, then that means that you are much more likely to become a magistrate in the early and mid-republic. And, you know, you've kind of got the automatic authority and honor that comes with being from the patricians. But that starts to change. And by the time we have a lot of written history, the difference is much less important. But one of the reasons for that is that the plebs themselves had rebelled in the mid-republic. And they'd said, we want more representation in the Senate. We want more power in the magistracies, rather. And they had done something which is called the secession of the plebs, which is sort of like going on strike. Mm. They went to the Aventine Hill, which is the hill in the south of Rome, and stood on it and said, we're not playing anymore until you give us a magistrate. To that effect.
So we want somebody who will directly be acting in our interests.
Yeah, exactly. That's a more elegant way of putting it.
we're not playing.
And what they got out of this is a magistrate, and over time there grew to be more of these, called the Tribune of the Plebs. And he's a magistrate who is meant to act for the interests of the plebeians. And he has various powers, but the most important one, which only two other guys in the Republican Constitution have, is the veto. Mm. He can veto laws.
So him and the consuls.
Yeah, he and the consuls can veto.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so they got a lot of power out of this in a way.
Yeah.
This is an interesting role because over time, and you can certainly see parallels to this in modern political systems, the people who occupy this role of tribunes of the plebs don't necessarily act for the people. And remember, being a plebeian over time becomes less of a barrier to becoming a consul or a praetor. So what they become is very important figures who can veto anything and therefore are cultivated by other magistrates and would-be magistrates. And right at the end of the Republic, their power to veto is something that is really abused. They're not putting that veto in place for the interests of the people necessarily. They're doing it because they're on somebody's side in the great civil war contests of the late Republic. So this is a role that begins, we would say, I think, with the best intentions, but one that is really skewed, as many of the elements of the Roman constitution are, towards particular interests when the Republic starts to fall apart. So the Tribune of the Plebs is going to be an important figure as we go through the first century.
So how did the power of the veto factor in when you need a dictator to call the shots?
Well, when you have a dictator, all bets are off. The role of dictator, which sounds entirely negative to us, is actually something that the Romans planned for. And it doesn't mean somebody who's tyrannical and gets rid of all their enemies.
No, they just ended up being that way. It was a byproduct of power going to your head a little bit.
Exactly. The dictator role is something that you can invoke when there's a crisis at Rome. All right. So
So the Carthaginians are attacking us too much. We need somebody to pull us up by our bootstraps.
Exactly. It's usually during a time of war when it's all going terribly wrong, where the consuls being able to veto each other and having arguments in the Senate is not useful. So it's a bit like during the Second World War, you know, there was a coalition government in Britain. They didn't have the Conservatives and Labour fighting each other. They just all got together, shared out the cabinet positions and said, okay, we have to put all our efforts towards the war effort. Mm. So being dictator, however, is not having a cabinet. Being dictator is one man who's going to just say, this has to happen. It's meant to be a temporary role. It's meant to last 6 months maximum, and then you go back to normal unless you really need to continue it. So, for example, in the first century, it was invoked by Sulla. He did give it up. Even Sulla, who had broken various other rules and changed them, knew that it was temporary and he gave it up. Mm-hmm. The problem will come with Julius Caesar when he holds on to that role.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's a role that's going to be abused in the late Republic too.
So where did the Republic start to go wrong then?
It's the million-dollar question in a way.
Yeah.
There are two things that happen and they're interconnected that seem to be particularly important. One that we'll see is, in theory at least, all of these magistrates are meant to be working for the glory and the good of Rome. In the first century BCE, and we'll go into more detail about this later, there are what we think of as the rise of private armies. So armies becoming loyal to their general rather than to Rome. And this is partly as a result of them being on campaign for so long with one particular general because there's so much war going on around the Roman world.
You trust your general. He knows what he's doing. But when he says that you want to do something that goes against Rome, who are you going to follow? Yeah.
And you might never have been to Rome. Yep. By that period, they're starting to get more and more troops from the provinces that they've created. The other very significant and perhaps going back further problem is land. So land is at the basis of all Roman power and authority, and land is also a problem. And this is not just a population problem, it's an equality problem. Before the first century BCE, probably going back as far as the third, the Roman elites have started gathering more and more land for themselves into what we call latifundia. And that just means broad estates, mm-hmm. huge estates. So instead of most Romans growing enough food for themselves and maybe some to sell, the elites start buying up this land and you end up with a lot of what we call the landless poor who flood into the city. Some of them will be employed, some of them are not. And then you've got a poverty problem and a desire for land and a need for land. And that is exacerbated by people having armies for years on campaign and then perhaps laying them off and they need land. Everyone needs land, but the elite have amassed it together. Mm-hmm. Does this sound familiar from anything that's happening now in terms of wealth? So, for example, the elder Pliny says, the men of olden times believed that above all, moderation should be observed in landholding. For indeed, it was their judgment that it was better to sow less and plow more intensively. Virgil, too, I see, agreed with this view. He's talking there about Virgil's Georgics. To confess the truth, the latifundia have ruined Italy and soon will ruin the provinces as well. Six owners were in possession of half of the province of Africa at the time when the Emperor Nero had them put to death. That's from Pliny's Natural History, Book 18, Chapter 7. So
Nero clearly had his own way of dealing with that problem.
So, yeah, indeed, yeah. Just get rid of it. It's probably not why Nero actually killed them. Now, Pliny is obviously a later source from the Flavian period, from the late 1st century CE, and he's actually talking about something that happens in the imperial period. But he's seeing it as going back to the Republic, the problem of land being amassed amongst the very few.
And still a problem.
Yeah, and continuing to be a problem in his time, which is interesting that this hasn't been solved. But it becomes the rolling issue of the first century BCE. And one of the things that will get people popularity and power is claiming that you're going to be able to solve this or you're going to try and solve it by forcing the Senate to divide up some of this land they own. You've kind of got this conflict of people with power and money and the needs of the masses and who's prepared to give some power up in order to provide this society which is actually run for the ordinary people.
So at this point, and it's tied up with the power of the people, I suppose, you're going to get the development of factions. So there were two factions in Rome, and I'm tempted to draw too many comparisons to modern politics, which, if I understand correctly, is something that I shouldn't be doing. Yeah. So can you explain the factions and how they're different to democratic and republic kind of ideals?
Yeah, well, look, we use the word factions because the Romans used the word factio. They're often known as the optimates and the populares, so the optimates and the popular party. Optimate means the best people.
Yeah.
Populares means for the people. But it's not an exact parallel. And obviously, the Roman system of government is nothing like any kind of modern constitution. So we tend now to talk about factions. And broadly speaking, the optimates represent the traditional senatorial view that power should be held amongst those who are well-born, who have traditional authority, who will hold stability, who want to uphold the Republican constitution, even though it's not really working anymore.
So, and they are more conservative?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
And the other ones which are more progressive?
Yeah, progressive, radical, you could use either of those words.
Yeah.
Want to do things like have land reform. Yeah. Land reform is a big important part of this. To control, to constrict, if you like, the power of the Senate in some areas, particularly in law courts.
Mm.
All right, so the Senate is not the absolute arbiter of every single legal procedure or the important ones. This kind of achieves a certain amount of popularity with those landless poor. They're prepared to do things like enroll in the army people who don't have land, because traditionally to get into the army you had to have a certain amount of land. So you would actually be a farmer.
Yeah.
Who would go off and fight in the army for a bit and then come back.
Okay.
It's not really working anymore because you can't be a farmer on any big scale if you're going to go off for years.
Yeah.
One of the problems I think most people see is that the optimates want to continue a system whose origins have disappeared. It worked when those origins were there, when you didn't have a vast empire to go out and police. Circumstances have changed and it's not working for a lot of Romans anymore. And you've got very ambitious Romans, the result of that highly contested career ladder and these generals who are ambitious. Some of them will play to the populares, to that populist cause. So some historians are quite cynical about what's going on amongst the populares because they think those politicians or generals are actually saying things that will please the people in order to get their votes or to get their backing. So you will get some historians who say this is not genuine democracy in action. This is not people who really want equality. They want a power base to back them. Just to put some faces to this, the final conflict here, or the most important one, I guess, is between Pompey and Julius Caesar. And Pompey's on the optimates side, the senatorial side. Julius Caesar is very much a populist.
So it sounds like a great system in theory. Most systems seem to be great in theory, but it's let down by the people and time.
Blame the people. Well, it's a great system for those who already have hold power.
Yeah.
I have to say, as a woman, I don't find it a very attractive system. Through all of this, we're talking about who could vote. No woman could vote, not even an elite woman. Of course, you have a whole lot of people who aren't citizens. And really, we shouldn't let all of this pass without mentioning that the whole system is based on having a huge amount of unpaid labor in the form of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I don't think it's a great system, but it is a system that works in terms of Roman society for many centuries, with people getting annoyed with it, such as the secession of the plebs, but something that they manage to regulate for roughly four centuries before it starts to not work for the people who are in control anymore.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review there. Reviews help other people find the podcast. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook and shout out to our 5,000 fans that we've now got on there. And you can follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, how did the fall of the Roman Republic begin? What was the key event that sets things off? If you answer that a pair of Gracchi might cause a bit of a Gracchus, then you'd be pretty much right. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.